I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives.
Correct. Oh, we started now. Yes.
Yes, of course we've started.
I'd been working at the Playbox Theatre, and I'd worked as an ASM on a show, a Louis Nara show, The Golden Age.
The golden years of Hollywood. That was what I loved.
Absolutely don't profess to be good at it at all. I could study and I could be much more diligent in my homework.
So in a sense, you know, I think really good directors are really good editors.
I was really incapable of going on, not just as a writer, but I felt as if I was incapable of going on as a human.
One more day before the storm. And Trevor says, stop. He said, you look like little Lord Fauntleroy, dip the wig.
They swooped in and just... Every scene I had with all those different people, they just made it work.
But after some time, I realised that grey comes in many, many hues.
I've had the luck, and without the luck, I know plenty of entertainers out there that are wonderful, funny, just never had the breaks.
I'm what I would call a dancer's dancer. Like, all I ever wanted to do was dance.
You've got a better memory than me, that's for sure.
Oh, I've done my research. I've cheated.
And you'd had a little piece of paper there, mind you, so have I.
We both had pieces of paper, so that's been
right. I wasn't silly, was I?
No, I think it was great, yeah. Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you, Peter. God bless.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome back to Stages. We've missed you. It's good to be back, especially as we enter our seventh season of the podcast, meaning this year we might just hit our 500th episode. Wouldn't that be nice? So much has happened on our stages in the 3 months hiatus of Stages. Festivals and shows have come and gone. New shows opening, seasons beginning, and announcements made every other week regarding a new theatrical offering to entice us indoors to see a show. We'll no doubt cover much of that in the year ahead, and also celebrate many of the creatives contributing to the performing arts today and in days gone by. You are guaranteed an insightful, informative, and entertaining listen with each episode of the podcast that converses with creatives about craft and career. A show that is garnering much applause and attention is Tim Minchin's Groundhog Day. Groundhog Day the musical made its Australian premiere at Melbourne's Princess Theatre on February 1st. Incidentally, February 2nd is the actual Groundhog Day. Direct from its record-breaking return season at London's Old Vic, the Australian production will play a 13-week season in Melbourne. Groundhog Day the musical is a gloriously joyful and heartwarming production from the award-winning minds of Australia's one and only Tim Minchin, the writer of the iconic 1993 film Danny Rubin, and director Matthew Warchus. Broadway veteran Andy Carl returns to Groundhog Day after his critically acclaimed reprisal at London's Old Vic as Phil Connors, the role he originated on Broadway, which won him an Olivier Award and a Tony nomination. He was previously seen in the Broadway revival of Into the Woods and leading the Broadway musical Pretty Woman as Edward Lewis. Other notable theatre credits include the Broadway revival of On the 20th Century, the title role in Rocky, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, 9 to 5, Legally Blonde, Wicked, The Wedding Singer, and Saturday Night Fever. Elise McCann is most well known for originating the role of Miss Honey in the Australian production of Matilda, for which she won the 2016 Helpman Award. Her breadth of musical theatre experience is extensive, with celebrated credits that include Lucille Ball in Everybody Loves Lucy, Mary Flynn in Merrily We Roll Along, and most recently for her performance as Donna in the 2023 20th anniversary tour of Mamma Mia! The Musical. Andy and Elise were recently in Sydney, where we caught up to discuss the extraordinary show they're currently navigating and the many joys and challenges of a career in musical theatre. It's good to be back.
The fan, that's his fan, right?
Yeah, that's his fan.
So that's fan mode. No, my turn now.
I'm in fan mode.
Auto, medium, high. Where are we? We're at we're at low. Oh, no, we're at low. That says we're at low.
Okay,
oh,
now high. We're high. Now we're auto. Now we're low.
Okay, this is as low as it goes.
As low as it goes.
As low as it goes.
Can you go any lower?
This is on low.
That's the lowest.
He can go lower.
I'll drive.
He's got a super low.
Or I
can
turn
voice.
It completely off.
Yeah, let's turn it off, and we'll put it on if. And as a podcast, so we can talk about. Yeah, that's much better. But if we need to put it on, we can acknowledge that there's a
exactly
an air conditioner happening because it's such a stinking day.
I know, what a day.
All right, so there we go. Apologies for the weather today. We've had a big thunderstorm, and it's just has been unpleasant to see any of our great city, Andy.
Yeah, well, the weather is so unpredictable as it is in Groundhog Day, as a matter of fact. And I play a weatherman, and so it's no surprises here.
And there we go, the first spruiking for the show that we're about to talk about today, as well as a whole lot of other things. So Andy Carl and Elise McCann, stars of the musical Groundhog Day, now playing in Melbourne. Welcome to the Stages podcast.
Thank you so much for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
The central premise of the show finds a man stuck in the repetition of a single day. Hopefully not a day like today. It's a feeling that we've all had. Is deja vu a thing?
Is deja vu? It's certainly a psychological dilemma that actually exists. They wouldn't have named it if it wasn't. Mm-hmm. It wasn't existing. And I certainly have had some moments on stage with this show of deja vu, feeling like I've been here again because it's my fourth incarnation of this show. But I take all of the deja vu in I welcome it.
There's like a lovely thing Matthew Watches, our director, talks about where he's like, he's not a woo-woo man at all, but he talks about this thing of like, there's elements of like the mystic that kind of just happen in life, which is kind of how I see deja vu. And that it happens, whether you believe in it as being deja vu, whether you believe in it as being coincidence, whatever it is, like these moments of like things syncing up, or these things, you know, you think about someone and they call, like just things happen. And you know, I think it's nice to move through life thinking that they can mean something to help us add meaning and purpose to what we're doing.
Absolutely. All those sliding door moments and happy accidents.
Mm. Yeah.
Which obviously are there for some reason. Who knows? And those out-of-body experiences. Yeah.
Certainly, are we manifesting it? Are we, or is it coincidence?
True.
There's a great joke in the show where Andy says, and his character says to one of the characters, do you ever have deja vu? And she's like, I don't think so. But I'll have to ask the kitchen. And so when you asked if we had deja vu, I thought immediately. Mm.
Well, is it a French dish? Yeah. Or, you know, is it French? Deja vu sounds so French. Yeah. I'll get one. Two deja vus, please. Yeah.
to take away. Phil Connors talks about, you know, this repetition of a day. There are 100 other days that he could think of that he would like to repeat. I think a holiday with a babe on the beach, I think, would be a lovely one to repeat, if that was your thing. do you have days which you would like to repeat again and again and again? That's significant days that stand out for you?
You know that feeling when I booked my first, I guess it goes all the way back, my first show where I was getting, I booked the job and I'm going to get paid a paycheck to do this. I was writing about this recently. I'm just writing down stuff that I think over the years, especially during Groundhog Day, because I'm doing this for the fourth time, and I thought I maybe should write things down now. But it makes me recall how I feel in certain moments, and I compare it to like getting a Tony nomination or something, or you know, booking Groundhog Day. It's all relatively the same. Feeling that I had. So my first job in some rinky-dink theater in Baltimore, Maryland was just as important to me and hit me just as hard as getting a Tony nomination for three times for the third time, you know,
winning that Olivier
Award. The third time was just as good. It was to be able to recall parts of your life that really hit you hard. There's certain things like that really make me smile.
Yeah, and those incredible highs.
Yeah.
Because as Phil experiences, days can be mundane when we fall into a routine and, you know, with work and all that we do.
And you blink and your life's passed. And you're like, how did I end up here? Like, how am I living this same day over and over again?
Do you have a day that you'd like to repeat?
You know, it's funny, as you were asking that question, I was thinking, and there are lots of moments in my life where amazing big things have happened that have, you know, kind of would typically be the things. But honestly, if I am really, really honest, it's like probably a day that I could recreate myself. Like some of the best days I think I've ever had are when I have made space for the things that are important. Like waking up, having coffee, seeing my family, seeing my nephews, going to the beach. Like, I feel like I look back on those days and I'm like, there's such a sense of like peace. And I think I'm perpetually in pursuit of peace because the life that we live is so hectic.
Yeah.
And so when you ask a question like that, I'm like, wow, why am I not? Well, I guess because life gets in the way and you also do other things. But it's kind of nice to know that I can probably recreate some of the best days of my life, which is quite freeing, actually, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the simple things.
Pretty much the simple things in life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Andy, you've been with the show from the start. I think it premiered at the Old Vic, didn't it, in London in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
Has it changed much, this production that we're seeing now in Melbourne?
Physically, it's become a tighter, better show based on the fact that we can go back in and maybe edit something, or people like Elise bring something new to the character that you've never seen before, and how can we work the show around that? And that's what I love about the show, is that it does center itself around the characters that are in it. It does move very fast, whether it was in 2016 or 2024. It keeps moving fast. It's actually a little bit faster now. So physically, yes, it has changed. We used to have about 5 revolves on the stage, the show's manic enough as it is. The days are repeating. We thought the revolves could help repeat the days, and it worked like a clock. And Matthew Wirtjes is a genius. Mm-hmm. Yet, did we need them? Apparently not, because the show works even better as we have our cast members create the revolve of the days within it. So it physically is a little different, and it is tighter, and it is I keep finding new moments all the time, which keeps me invested all the time. So I think we've crafted something that is even better than 2016, which I never thought could happen, because it was one of and has remained my favorite show that I've ever been a part of.
And I think this is a particularly unique team, because they are constantly in pursuit of refining, which doesn't always happen.
Mm.
Sometimes people kind of, you create something, it goes well, or you're really proud of it, and you're like, great, let's leave that, and then you move on to something else. But this team's always looking for new things, so much so that after our first preview, Tim Minchin was downstairs in our dressing rooms and was like, Andy, I think I want you to like try this line instead of this line in a song.
And it worked
better. And Danny Rubin sent us a text like 2 days ago. It was like, I'm not sure about this, like, should we change it to this? What about these options? Do you think any of them work? And you know, they're always thinking about it and trying to find new things, which is so cool for us. To
the construct of the show is refinement. When you repeat the days over and over, Phil certainly tries to find refinement constantly and tries to do something better each day when he does finally stop being so selfish. So I think it's inherent in the piece, inherent in the character and the tone of the ideas, that we all are looking for little things. And I see Elise come up with new things all the time, too. She'll throw in looks that I've never seen. I'm like, oh, did you try that tonight? She's like, yes, I did. It's like, that was great. That was great.
It's precious to have a creative team that still want to tinker with it and refine it.
So much.
The most classic example in the world of musical theatre was perhaps Merrily Roll Along, a show that you know very well, Elise. I just saw it in New York. And
beautiful
it
production.
Seems to be now be perfection. They seem to have fixed everything that was wrong with it.
Yeah. We were very lucky as well. Like, our production was able to utilise a lot of the elements that they had adjusted for that production.
This is at the Hayes Theatre, directed by Dean Bryant.
Exactly. Yeah. So obviously there have been many incarnations of Merrily along the way, in versions that had, you know, huge casts all the way down to much smaller casts. And along that process, there's been multiple versions of the script, of the score, and we kind of got permission to, I guess, draw upon all of those, which is what they've done with this Sonia Friedman production as well. And I think you're right. It's about getting to the heart of what the piece is and finding the simplest way to tell that, because the story and the heart of it in itself is complex enough that, you know, just kind of pairing all the other stuff back to get to it actually makes it resonate all the more. And I agree. I've seen this production and it's a beautiful, beautiful version.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it must be very exciting, the 4 incarnations of Groundhog Day that you've done: London, Broadway, the revival in London, Melbourne. You're dealing with a whole new family each time you do it, aren't you? So that must, you fire off every new personality that you're working against.
Yeah, I tried to explain it to somebody the other day. It's like living in a multiverse of this show, which is, you know, What parallel universe am I in this time? Because you see the same costumes, the same wigs, but then the completely different people inside of everything, and I'm just, which actually helps me a lot, because when you repeat something and your character has to sort of get caught up in the mystery of and the magic of repeating the same day, and to be thrown off by it. I do get thrown when I sometimes think of an old cast member in a costume or a voice that I'm hearing now that was different than it was, and I'm like, am I here? Am I really doing this with? So it is personal, the magic as well as the just physically being in the show with different people. It's wonderful, and everybody brings something absolutely special of their own, because every character in the show is so vital to the entire story.
It's pretty amazing, because Andy, I mean, is a rare beast in not only, obviously, for anyone that hasn't seen the show, you should see it because it's really good and Andy's amazing. Everyone's amazing, but, you know, Andy gives particularly a phenomenal performance. But he has this amazing patience. You know, he's had to tech the show 4 times. Oh. Tech is a hard process. This is a highly technical show. There's, you know, automation, there's illusions, there's, you know, everything's sped up. The music is hard. Like, it's a really tough show. And he has such patience with that. And also just as an actor, like, everyone is constantly probably giving him different things. Never gives a note, doesn't, like, you know, he's willing to play and he'll bounce off what you give, or he's, you know, done that with us anyway, and so I can only imagine it's with everyone, and that's rare. Not all actors are like that, so I think it's, you know, takes a special energy to
what you're talking about.
It's true. It takes true. Well, yeah, it's
no,
true.
I, it's, you know what I'm talking about. What you are mentioning is really interesting, because it is when you're offered something new, it keeps you invested in the show. And I want everything about me to be invested in every scene. And when you're offered something new, it's always great for an actor.
There are huge demands placed on you as Phil Connors in the show. I saw it in 2017, and it's just the most amazing show, and you give the most amazing performance. I want to quote from the esteemed former New York Times Ben Brantley, who was the great reviewer there. He said, "It's Phil's journey more than his destination that makes Groundhog Day such joy, as Mr. Carl gives many splendid life to each faltering on the road to self-discovery. Anger, prickliness, outrage, wonder, godlike omnipotence, drunken what-the-hell exhilaration, suicidal angst, zen-like resignation. Mr. Carl turns these different feelings into a replete gallery of self-portraits drawn with both comic panache and genuine feeling."
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Ben. It's a beautiful description, because it is such, physically and emotionally, the demands on you are very heavy. How do you manage 8 shows a week? How do you, are you exhausted at the end of the show, or you're sort of ready to do it again?
This new 5-show weekend schedule that the Australians seem to love is a little tough.
We do a different schedule. So we do Friday night, 2 Saturday, 2 Sunday, and we don't do a Wednesday matinee, which is
more
unique.
Used to. So,
But even harder.
It all is just navigation of physicality. I certainly try to take care of myself, because I know the lift we're doing. It is a sport sometimes, musical theater, as much as it is a acting.
Song and dance.
Yes, it is. You must enjoy the sport of it, because everybody's working very, very hard. Everyone. I can't say I'm the only one working this hard. The emotional arc of this show is a train ride, and I love it. I had to discover things when we first started about who I was in order to answer the questions that the show is asking. Now I'm asking myself different questions outside of that. So emotionally I'm changed over the past 8 years as a person. I've grown into certain things, but to be thrust back into the show, you start to ask yourself different questions this time, and new things arise, and it keeps me very, very connected to it.
In my preparation for this chat, I was amazed to learn that Punxsutawney, PA, does exist, and Groundhog Day does exist. It wasn't a fiction made up by Ramis and for the film.
Totally. No. I didn't know that either until we
started
doing
the
show.
You really thought that was just a made-up?
Yes, I did. Are you kidding me? Who wears that old-worldy clothing and, like,
Punxsutawney.
Yes, exactly. Really, like, what a name.
But what happens here? Isn't there some
Weathered people that
tell. Yeah, but isn't there some strange holiday you all celebrate that doesn't happen?
I'm sure there is. But you know what's crazy?
Can I just segue there? Hang on to that thought, Elise, because I was about to go into. You were born in Baltimore, Maryland. Yeah. And Elise, you were born in Wodonga, Victoria.
Yes.
Yes, Andy, every small town has an annual festival or event that fosters community. And Grafton has a jacaranda festival named after the signature tree. Currajong has a scarecrow festival. The Gaira lamb and potato festival. The Walleye Goanna pulling festival.
Oh, my gosh.
The Parks Elvis impersonators festival.
Oh, I got to go to that one.
Nimbin's Mardi Gras, a marijuana pro-legalization festival.
Well, hello, Nimbin.
That's where I'm going after Elvis.
Ballarat's begonia festival. And Queen Bianne's Festival of Ability. So they exist everywhere.
They do, right.
Yeah. And I'm sure, like we find Punxsutawney funny, I bet you find Queen Bianne funny.
Yeah, I think there's a small town in every country and every state around this world that everybody can invest in as the town that they think is the small town that they want to get out of.
I think that's why the show works in so many ways, because as much as it's about like this one little town in, you know, in America, it is essentially about community, and every person has or comes from a community somewhere, and that is the heart of the show. So you, as you said, like, I guess it kind of, whether it's me growing up in Epping, Dural or Wodonga, or you in Baltimore, like, it's, you know, there's a relation there to that. What I was going to say to you before was that because we actually had Groundhog Day, February 2nd, whilst we've been doing this, it was the day after we opened. So, of course, we opened on February 1st. Of course, you'd be remiss to not do a second opening on February 2nd and play into every possible joke about the repetition that you can. So we did a second opening on February 2nd, which is actual Groundhog Day. And because of the time difference, at the end of the show, it was basically 6 a.m. February 2nd in Punxsutawney, so we could watch live the actual festival. Groundhog Day festival, which was very cool. And that's when I think some of our cast realized.
Like watching the show, I'm sure.
Some of it is actually the knob. Looks like the knob. Like,
well, as if Punxsutawney wasn't enough, Gobbler's Knob
is a thing. Yeah, that's what I mean. It's like, who's naming this stuff?
See, you guys are laughing. I'm just like, it's just what we do. It's what we do there.
And Phil the Groundhog is named after King Philip.
Is that where he's named after?
Absolutely,
There you go.
Is that a tuna fish? King Philip tuna?
No, not at all.
Sadly, no.
So, Andy Carl and Elise McCann, stars of the musical Groundhog Day, now playing in Melbourne. Welcome to the Stages podcast.
Thank you.
So nice to be here.
The central premise of the show finds a man stuck in the repetition of a single day, a feeling that we've all had. Is deja vu a real thing?
Oh my God, I was just like, hang on, is this the middle of the thing?
Oh, you got caught.
Well played, sir!
I gotcha. He doesn't know what we're talking about. What are we talking about? He's looking at us like,
why are they reacting?
No, didn't you just ask that before?
I'll have to ask the kitchen.
Yeah. I've just started this conversation.
I know, this is... I think we're... What's happening right now?
I don't know.
Okay. Nothing.
Anyway, let's skip to the next segment.
I think it could be, yeah.
Groundhog Day is a real day. It's a morning.
It sure is.
There we go. Okay.
Oh, that was so good. For a second, I really was like, is this the middle of the thing? What is happening here?
That's right.
Well played.
You haven't been in enough Groundhog Day interviews. It comes right.
No, don't tell me. Is that a standard sort of?
Oh, yeah, of course
really?
It is.
No,
it's not.
It's me. Okay.
Steve. Yeah.
Really?
So many people have done it. I did it on
But I got you. Yeah, your
did.
Eyes didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, deja vu.
Good delivery.
And all of the litany of welcome comments on Facebook to you on opening night, you know, were just repetition of the same line.
Everybody
was doing it.
It's true.
It's nice. So, what is your morning ritual when you wake up? We've all got them. The alarm clock goes off. I guess you've got an alarm clock.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Do you wake up to a beep or a radio station? Music.
I wake up to it's like a white noise kind of thing.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So it's not too aggressive.
So it's
not too aggressive.
It's more gentle.
I go full aggressive.
Do you?
I go full aggressive, get up, get out of bed, and immediately to the coffee machine.
Yeah, right. I get up and to my white noise, and then I meditate, and then I pretty much go and get coffee.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You're so much calmer than me.
Right. Okay, so coffee's waking us up. What's next?
I generally start on emails.
Right.
So I have another business, so I tend to get to work or sometimes go to yoga class, which also sounds like I sound like I'm way more zen than I actually am. Anyone that meets me in real life is like, this is all a fallacy, this cannot be accurate, but wait till you meet me without having done any of those things.
Well, yeah, that's when you need to take care of the insanity.
That's right. What about you? What happens after coffee?
After coffee, we go to the gym because this show is quite tough, quite physical, and I need to stay in some sort of shape, and it's a heavy lift, which I'm fine with. I also walk around in my underwear for a portion. And if that doesn't sell a few tickets, I don't know what will.
Both in the show and in real life. There you go. What a win.
Okay, good. I go for the...
What do you do?
Yeah, I go for the kettle and to
boil it. You're a cup of tea man?
No, for coffee, for okay. The plunger. Mm. But when the alarm goes off, and it's Radio National, I play Connections from the New York Times and Wordle, just to wake up gently.
Yes.
And then go out and...
get the brain firing.
Flick open the...
coffee is like the treat for me. I do have a coffee machine, and yet I rarely use it. It's like... I wake up and I'm so excited to have like a really good coffee that I feel like if I meditate and then I'm just like, that's the reward. And then the day's started, you know,
because I'm out of the house. Yeah, I try to drink it as quickly as possible and get the caffeine into the bloodstream so that I can open one eye and then the next.
Yeah.
Can you sleep in on show days or the alarm goes off, but surely you're waking at 9 or 10 o'clock. You're not waking up at 5 to go to the gym, I hope.
I think we're early birders,
we're both
right?
Early risers, really? Yeah. Back in the day, I didn't used to be. Like, back in the day, I would definitely sleep till 9 or 10 in my younger years. But now, yeah, I've just got work to do, stuff to do, people to see, business to happen.
Good, that's right. Good. Take advantage of the day.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. It is nice.
The actor's nightmare is full of horrors of appearing on stage when... in your underwear.
I've done it too.
Or not knowing where you are, what place you are, while everyone else carries on around you confidently. I've spoken to actors who report that, you know, a form of stage fright can set in when there's that repetition. What other occupation has? You go through
thing,
the same
exact
thing
same place, exact
every
same
day.
Outfit, yep.
That person passes you when you're passing out there and all of that sort of thing. Do you have any anxiety in a show that is about repetition and you're sort of, have I done this scene before? Is it for the first time?
Definitely. So people actually ask me that question about Andy all the time because you've done it so many times, I guess. But yes, 100%. Something about saying the same words over and over again in the same place, it moves to a different part of the brain. So you actually can't recall it in the same way that you would anything else that's really fresh at the front. So when it starts to go to that part of the brain, you go through this little weird place where you have to just start trusting that it's there because if you actively try to recall it, you can't. Mm. And then you're in danger zone. I had a night, the reason Andy was looking at me is because I had a show where I thought I was speaking words. I was trying to speak words and it came out as gibberish. And I was like, I was brought up in taffeta presses and brought to be pretty and precious or something. I was like,
I think
it was
that's
like,
exactly it, which is kind of odd that you remember it.
So weird.
Well.
It was like blah, blah. I couldn't get the words out. And then I literally had a split second where I was like, Elise, you have to get back on this train or this train is crashing. Mm. Because once you get off, it's really hard to get back on. And for me, that song is a super wordy song and it's just me. There's no one else to like help.
Tim Minchin does not help. It does not create easy lyrics, but he does create emotion inside
That's
of
it.
His complex.
So if you stay in the character, you can kind of get there. And I had that when I played Miss Honey as well. There was one night where I was singing Pathetic and it just like it went off the train tracks and I just couldn't get back on and it's terrifying.
Yeah.
And I guess that's slightly different to what you were asking though, I guess. You were asking about the repetition
anxiety.
Of, oh, I've done this day, hang on, are we up to day one, day two, day three? And that does happen too, actually, you're right. In this show, most shows you don't have that, but in this show, there are the occasions where I'll come off and in the first previews, and I'd be like, are we day three? Do we go to day four? What happens next? Hang on, do we go back to the diner or are we going, no, we're going to Reed's broadcast. Like it does, your brain plays tricks on you because it's trying to figure it out.
It's also that these scenes are a sum of parts. So you're putting these days together and you're making sure that the one day is said this way so that the second day can be funny.
Slightly adjusted.
The third day has the payoff.
Yeah.
So it's like a very long standing joke essentially because it is repetition and I think the audience I know the audience loves this repetition. They laugh at the things that they recall within a scene that happened just seconds before.
Yeah, because they're in on the joke. Yeah. You know? And so it's same, and it's the same scene, but different. That's the hard part, because you say...
I think the anxiety comes, like, you just want the payoff. You want to get to the payoff of the joke, and you want it to land so well, because it really does. When it works, it is gangbusters, and people just love it. And there's nothing that makes me happier than making that constructing those jokes to work the way they do.
I think it was the previews in Broadway, you had an accident. Did you pop your knee or hamstring, or there was
Tore my ACL. Right. Complete tear. It was two nights before opening on Broadway, which set me into a spiral of all sorts of mental anguish, but also happiness of being there on my opening night. I made it to opening night with a brace around my knee. That was a several years long doing the show. It was complicated enough, and I was dealing with an injury at the same time was just another level of keeping my mind on my body at the same time while I was doing all those complex jokes that I was just talking about. So it made it manic for me for a long time. It got better as I got through the show, and I was able to get rid of the brace and finally perform like the last few months without it. But it did send me into like a PTSD and a depression afterwards. I thought maybe I was like, I'm not built for this. I can't do these shows. I think I might have to give up the career if I'm gonna, you know, be injured like this. And I felt bitter. Like we had lost the Tony, and we closed early, and to even to rave reviews like Ben Brantley's, you're just like, why is this show not running? It put me in a very I don't know, little depressive state. And I think from going there to 8 years later to London to revive it, I had so much to prove to come back and show. I know the show is so, so amazing, and I know that I can do it, and I got an opportunity. And how often does that happen in life? It's not very often. And when it broke box office records in London and it had all the great reviews, it was truly like a spiritual release, the weight off my shoulders in a lot of ways. So I think I thank the show for coming back, and certainly now we're in Melbourne doing it as well. So I'm so thankful that I A, am not injured, but B, thankful that the audiences are there and that we're performing this amazing show.
It must have been quite cautious for a while approaching that moment in the show where you had the accident and sort of getting back on the horse, so to speak, in that section. Yeah.
This show has taught me a lot about life.
Resilience.
And resilience.
There will be mornings you'll be utterly defeated by your laces. Days when every look looks condescending, empty smiles and empty faces. The same old places, the stunning stasis. Just let your spirit slip away. Let all your troubles crumble and decay. There's more than one way out if at the end of the day you're at the end of your rope. Never give up hope. Never let yourself be defeated. If you tried it once, you can try again. A new day will follow. There's always tomorrow. Never listen to the unbelievers. You'll take your lasting farcical disaster. You play your part, you march the march, you don't complain. You find a way, another day surrounded
the show,
by
like the film,
cast,
doesn't shy away from being really dark. I mean, there's a suicidal sequence in the second act there. It's sung to a song called Hope. Which just reminds us that we can have those shittiest of days, but, give it another hour, another 2 hours, the next day, it's going to change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's great that it operates on all those levels. It's riotously funny, but also serves a really salient message about mental illness.
Absolutely.
You were just talking about this the other day.
Yeah. I think it's, to me, the hope sequence is such a powerful section of the show because it's a subject matter that we don't often deal with in theatre and or, you know, in life in general. People don't talk about it all the time, particularly suicide. And it's a subject matter that is everyone approaches with great caution. So to be able to find ways to communicate it with humour means that you're able to feel the severity of it but not close down on it. And then when, you know, you add the illusions and you add all the other elements to it and you've got the lyrics of a song saying the complete antithesis, like don't give up hope whilst this person is continuously trying to kill themselves, it does things to your brain that kind of makes your brain, I guess, hear the part about hope. Mm. And that's the part that we actually want people to end with. So I think it's a real masterpiece, that part of the show.
I think Tim Minchin really loves that, utilizing the dichotomy of images in songs.
Yeah.
You know, singing about having a dark side, which is a great song of his, but he can't help but feel, you know, play happy tunes, but then he's like, oh, I have a dark side too, and he's discovering the dark side, but you're also looking at the humor of trying to be so, you know, brooding amongst the most ridiculous ego that you're having. It sort of works against itself, which Tim Minchin he loves playing in that area.
I think we need that song. Like, if we didn't have that one, that's part of the movie, like, and it's an important part, but if we didn't have that section, you wouldn't actually be looking at the full gamut of the experience of, like, what it would be, you know what I mean? Like, it really kind of, you expect all the other things. You expect, oh, someone's going to get drunk, they're going to screw around, they're going to go crazy, whatever, but you kind of expect, I wonder what's going to happen there, but if we didn't show it, if we didn't really dig into it, I think we'd be doing a disservice to the piece and to people that go through those kinds of mental health challenges. Well, so
that,
I think that's really
existential
important.
Moment
really
that, we,
is.
That we all have when you know, things seem like they're not going to change, but well, Minchin has proven, I think, that he's the master of writing for character and writing for situation and music that advances the plot. I mean, it's a lovely mix of genres. There's folk music, country music. Yeah. I mean, hard rock at a particular moment. You really visit your inner meatloaf at one moment.
That's the name of my band, by the way.
Inner meatloaf, right? There's even a tap number. And what is a musical without a tap number?
Yeah. And it's good.
Mm. Yeah, it's beautiful. It's so good. Yeah, Lizzie G, our choreographer, really just did some amazing work. It's so clean.
It's still telling story.
Yeah, it's telling story. It's also just our amazing company that is so dedicated to telling the story through their feet, essentially, but also with everything that they're combining in the show. It's wonderful. We have everything. We have everything.
And it feels like it's like time passing, like tap shoes, that kind of sense of like time is also this thing, the one moment where we get to kind of see time speed up a bit. So it's really cool.
And the generosity of the creatives too, to pick out individual characters like Nancy and Ned Ryerson and give them these beautiful solos. I mean, that song of playing Nancy at the start of Act 2 is just beautiful.
Yeah. Well, here I am again, the pretty but naive one, the perky-breasted, giggly one-night stand. Is it my destiny to be a brief diversion, just a detour on the journey of some man? I'm not really one for asking. I'll play whatever role I'm cast in. We'll smile with perfect teeth and grimace underneath. I learned back in my teens, there's no point in protesting. If you look good in tight jeans, that's what they'll want you dressed in. Once you're known for low-cut tops, it's pretty hard to stop. It isn't easy to break free of playing Nancy.
It's one of the beautiful things about this show in particular, and something that's different than the movie, is we are discovering inner monologues of characters we took for granted, and certainly Nancy is one of them. It's this beautiful blonde girl who's going through her day, and Phil gets the repeating and takes advantage of that, and we realize that she, in the second act, she gets a little song to sort of tell us her inner monologue, which is odd. It sets us, why is this character we haven't really known before given a song? But then it unlocks the second act. It starts unlocking more characters. Ned Ryerson has a beautiful song, basically about, you know, death and the passing of a loved one, and acceptance of it. And it's teaches some really big lessons in the show.
On and on you stumble on towards the evening sun. She waits for you with open arms. You stare right through her. On and on you fall towards her. Cold embrace in shadowed doorway offers nothing. Still she draws you ever to her. On and on you stumble on towards the sinking sun. Turn a blind eye, fight or run. Rest assured, the night will come.
We find out more about Rita than in the movie, obviously, through a great performance, and through a lot of lyrics that you shouldn't lose while you're doing it, and you don't. So I think we're finding out about the characters that we never knew from the movie source material, which is the elevation of a beautiful musical theater piece, but just the piece in general and what its effect it has on the lead character.
And I think the Nancy piece, I also think that it's like so smart. Like Tim kind of did that, and Matthew did that in Matilda as well with Telly, the song that Mr. Wormwood sung. Mm-hmm. It's like this beautiful way, it's really smart. It's a great way of starting the second act because it gets people back in, but it's not essential to plot. So if someone were to say be late or miss or was still getting their brain back in, you're not losing the plot. But also it sets up the tone for what's to come next. And I think that like with everyone's just left act one with still laughing and thinking this is ridiculous, like in the ridiculousness of all of what's happening with Phil, and then we start the day again, and so of course they're coming back in thinking, okay, what's happening with this repeat? And it quickly doesn't have the repeat. Mm-hmm. We don't see the repeat, and it's so smart because it says, it instantly tells everyone that's not happening now we're looking deeper. Mm. And it also sets up the tone to go into the suicide, because it's actually, it's again got humor, but it's still got something deeper than that. So it kind of, they're so smart in the way they've constructed the piece. Yeah.
Those supporting characters are really humanized, unlike the film, which are there just to be goalposts in Phil's day, just to sort of deliver a particular gag. I love the sequence of quack doctors too.
Oh my God, Stark, I love
piss,
it.
Piss, piss, piss. You'll have to see the show to know what I'm talking about.
Analyze your isotopes.
So when did it all start for you, being seduced by the theatre and wanting to make it a vocation? Generally, it starts with the school productions or the drama teacher.
Sure, yeah. I think I was in high school and I could sing. Like I always had music around the house, so it was part of like my mother played organ for her church, so it was part of my life. So I joined the choir, and I think in my sophomore year of high school, I was asked by the choir teacher to come be a part of a show, like the summer musical. And then the second year, I got a part, and the part that I had was sort of the villain, and I got a laugh from the audience.
Judd Fry.
And I played Judd Fry, but it was General Bullmoose from Will Abner, which was the second year, my junior year, where I realized I can make an audience feel something. Everybody feels something at this particular time.
That's good, because I wondered why Judd Fry was getting a laugh.
Yeah, Judd Fry shouldn't have got a laugh. But it started hard with Judd Fry because I had broken my foot and I had a cast on for that entire show.
Oh my God!
I go hard when I'm doing a show.
But
when I did get that first laugh from an audience, I that was the drug that I have always, I keep taking. Like I need it.
Mm. You thought at one point you might be a voice teacher.
Yeah, I went to my university, Towson State University in Baltimore, Maryland, for 2 years, and studied voice and voice teaching, and I was I realized
like accents so, or singing.
Singing. Sorry. Singing. Yes. Sorry.
No. Could be either.
Well, with me, you'd guess that I'd be a singer, even though I'm not as good a singer as you. So I thought that might be a good idea, and then but the performing bug was really strong within me, and obviously still doing it now.
Rest is history.
Yeah.
And what about you, Elise? Was it the house conductor of Aston House and the annual music?
Oh my God! Look at you. I was the conductor of the school, of the choir at
your
school.
Year 11 play.
We won that, my year 11 play.
The Sunny South.
Oh my God! Look at you. You really know all these.
No, I have connections.
You really do. No, when I was little, I used to just always like write stories, and I would sing along. I wasn't very good back then. I was always out of tune, but I'd sing along to like cast albums or movie musicals that I'd watch with my grandma or my family. And my parents put me in drama classes. I think mostly to just like keep me entertained because I was a bit theatrical. And I did like dance classes, and I was the Ruffles Chips packet in the Sydney Easter Parade. It was a defining moment of my career. And I basically, yeah, just kind of kept going with that. And I loved it and was doing it, you know, did the school musicals and stuff and throughout school. But I never thought I would be an actor. I really thought I was going to be a journalist or a lawyer or something like that. Yeah. And I just happened to audition for drama school and got in. And so I decided to go. And then it kind of kept going. So, yeah.
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history.
But you do have a law degree,
yes.
I mean, well done.
Thank you.
Andy Carl and Elise McCann, stars of the musical Groundhog Day, now playing in Melbourne. Welcome to the Stages podcast. The central premise of the show is a man stuck in... Don't punch me!
I was like, oh my God, is this happening
here
again?
Here we go again.
No.
Well done.
He was clenching his fist. He was going to punch me. I am like, not Ned Ryerson, thank you. professional debuts. Where did you make your mark?
Where did I make my mark?
Tommy?
Tommy, like on a tour. I think I got people saw what I could do. A little bit further gamut of that was Altar Boys off Broadway, which is about a sort of faux Christian boy band. But it entailed us, the five of us, to step forward and utilize all our talents. And Jerry Mitchell saw me and put me in Legally Blonde. I started picking up jobs. People always referred back to that because they were just like, it was so amazing, it moved us so much. So Off-Broadway has its credit, you know, doesn't pay much, but you know, you can really be discovered there.
And Jerry Mitchell's been very faithful. You've done Pretty Woman as well.
Yeah, Pretty Jerry. Woman, yeah. Legally Blonde. We've been friends for a long time, and he's just he recognizes talent, but also people who
nurtures
are nice,
it and fosters
and he nurtures
it.
Yeah. It. He really does. He really cares, and I think it's a credit to him. And he's got endless energy, which is inspiring. I want to have endless energy, which is why I show up to work every night, full out. He says full out.
That's his catch cry, isn't it? Yeah. Yours, Fiddler on the Roof?
Fiddler on the Roof was my first professional show. Yes, I was like third person from the left, and it was a joy. But I reckon the first... Fiddler was great because I was total just ensemble and then covered. And then I saw the person that was playing like one of the roles, the minor roles, Fruma Sarah, she was leaving. And I was like, I can sing that. So I cold emailed our musical director at the time. I was like, hi, Stephen. I'm really loving doing the show. Thank you so much for having me. I know that Emma's leaving. I really think I could actually sing it. So if there's any chance I could audition, I'd love to. And he just wrote back, sure. And so I went and auditioned and got that and ended up taking that over. And that was like a really defining moment for me, not because it was like the role that anyone was like, oh, there she is. She's a star. I went on to like do ensemble and cover and swing and do all the things for years. But it was really great because one, it was the first time I got to like have a featured role, and two, it was really it was the first moment I was like, you can ask for some of the things that you want in your life, and you have to kind of also put yourself out there if there's something that you think you're right for, because we're not mind readers, and it's as much as it's a job where everyone else gets to choose what's on and what's happening, and if you get an audition, you know we do have the ability to have some agency in reaching out for things.
Yeah.
And then that served me well in other, like many other times, like actually working with Stephen Collier.
Yeah.
I remember being like, hey, I heard you're doing this. I love that show. I'd love to come in.
Falsettos.
And I had said similarly to the musical director, who was like someone I'd worked with. I was like, hey, I love Falsettos. If you haven't cast this, I'd love to come in. Lo and behold, they then chat and they're like, Stephen, if you're listening, Nigel, if you're listening, this is hilarious. I don't know if you've ever heard this. They then had a chat about the show. I'm like, what about this role? And they're like, oh yeah, what about Elise McCann? Oh, I was thinking of Elise McCann too. Great. So they just offered it to me. Little do they know that they were thinking of it because I told both of them to think of me.
Yes.
So, you just never know what's going to happen.
You've got to plant the seed, don't
that's
you?
It. Ask and thou shalt receive.
Yeah.
Now, at the beginning of the chat, we alluded to awards, 3 Tony nominations and an Olivier Award for you, Andy, and a Helpman Award for you, mm-hmm. Elise. Mm-hmm. What's it like receiving those nominations and then ultimately winning?
You first.
Okay, I mean, yours is slightly more prestigious, so let's have you go second.
No, the Helpmans are the Tonys of Australia.
They are. Look, I've always been really like stoked to get nominated for things and to win awards. It's such a lovely acknowledgement. I think that my first one, I think, was with Everybody Loves Lucy, and that meant such a massive thing because it was the first time I'd kind of had something like that happen, and I obviously like was a creator on that show as well, so that was really, really special. And then Matilda was so special with like all the awards for that, because I just loved the piece and it was such a same thing, it was a defining moment in my career. So winning the awards was amazing. In full honesty, the first award I won, when I won those awards, I was like, this is everything I ever thought that I wanted. And at the time, I was like, but I don't really have people to share it with, because I had gotten out of a relationship. I had, you know, was spent all my time focusing on the show. And it was a really like interesting moment. And it kind of was, it didn't take away from it at all. I was like, this is amazing. And I'm so grateful. But it also put things into perspective a little bit. And I'm actually really glad for that, because now, you know, if you get nominated for something, or, you know, I got nominated for Merrily and you don't win, and it's okay. Like, I don't mind if I don't win.
You're proving yourself.
Yeah, and I feel like as long as all I can do is my best on any given day, and yep, as long as I'm doing that, then that's all I can do.
Yeah.
You know, so whatever happens.
Yes, it's lovely to win, but what do they mean the next day?
Literally that. Yeah.
Something for your CV.
And like, that's the thing. Yeah.
It marks a time in your life, which is great. I think that's...
And they're useful for other work and all. They're for lots of things.
Sure. And yeah, producers love awards.
They do.
to be able to, like, you know, sell their show beyond the Broadway version, maybe go on tours and go overseas, things like that. It always helps. But as far as nominated, the first time was just glorious, and I wasn't expecting it for a nomination to come my way, and I was thrilled. And the second time I was nominated for Rocky, I was like, wow, this is amazing. I'm working towards something here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if I can get you know, the actual Tony, this would be great. I got nominated again for Groundhog Day, and I was also dealing with like injury at the same time while that nomination came out. Producers dropping out and vying and trying to compete. It became a competition for this award. All the press I had to do, I had to run around town and make sure I shook all the hands and make sure that I was doing the show at the top of my performance level, which is great, but it became too much of a pressure upon that as opposed to who I am and what I feel every night when I do the show, which is this glory. And not winning it became sort of devastating. I was like, I'm putting out so much energy. I'm putting out everything. Why is it not adding up to the win? It was another part of that whole like injury, manic, depressive moment. And you're like, oh, because you're not looking at what is the important thing, which is being available to the present and being grateful for being on stage and living your life through that as opposed to any award. I now have perspective on it where I will never again like compete for an award. I will compete for my opportunity on stage to my full hilt, and because I own that. The award doesn't own me. And I know that's a little woo-woo to talk about awards that way, but you have to look at it that way, especially with the egos of actors and what we do for a living. If you put
subjective.
That first, it becomes hard to enjoy everything else.
Yeah. And it's also like, it's a group of people's opinion in a specific period of time. It's like reviews can be amazing, and they're super useful to sell a show, but by the same token, they're one person's opinion.
Yep.
And if you're gonna believe the good ones, you gotta believe the bad ones, you gotta, you know. And it's that thing of, yeah, you have to just remember it's the art is subjective. All art is an offer, and what you want to do with that offer, you can choose to like it, you can choose to not like it, you can choose to take however you want, and it's, you know, it's up to us how we respond to it, but it doesn't make it right or wrong.
No.
You know?
Well, it's abundantly clear that you can probably take any story and give it a musical treatment, which is why I was fascinated by Rocky Balboa being given a musical treatment. I mean, I saw it, it came out in 76, so I saw it as a kid, around the same time I was watching Funny Girl and Showboat.
Great.
Never did I think those two genres could merge. So I'm fascinated, Andy. Tell me about The Rocky Journey. When did it first come into your world? And I hear fantastic things about the set design. It won lots of awards.
Yeah.
That the fighting choreography, and it was so realistic. Love to hear more.
Rocky, I thought, was a really bad idea as a musical, too. When I heard about the audition, I was like, they're going to, what? That's ridiculous. My agent had called me, they'd love for you to audition. I was like, what am I going to do? Is this a joke? Is it a parody? And he's like, no, it's very serious. So I went back and watched the film, which is actually a beautiful, simple love story between
won the Oscar for best picture.
Just really amazing, but it's so small, and it's the thing that is the driving force is the love in his heart, and fighting for his pride within himself. And that's the great underdog story that Rocky offers, which is powerful, obviously, through many incarnations of this film, through many sequels and prequels and everything else. So it's Sylvester Stallone was the one that came up with the idea. It was his idea. He thought of it, years before we actually got there, but he saw this as a musical, and it was his blessing, and for him to hand over the gauntlet of this role, which means so much to him, it was truly something that I was going to fight for and keep alive and make sure that I did it justice. So everyone in the creative team was really trying to hone what the movie captures, which is that heart, which is that, fighting for love and fighting for your pride in yourself and facing the greatest obstacles you could possibly face and jumping into a ring. And even though you're going to lose, you're going to give it everything you got. I think those are powerful, powerful parts of humanity, and they're powerful parts of writing songs. So we had a beautiful score. And we did throw in a little bit of the... We had songs that you need in Rocky, so it was this playing and with that medium and how we're gonna express the story in the best possible way. So my job as Rocky, I was Rocky every night. I was making sure that I was doing the right thing and talking slow and low and fighting for my heart and really making sure that Adrian fell in love with me because I love him, So it meant I had to truly believe it. You haven't heard me do this.
No,
so,
I haven't.
That's fantastic.
Amazing.
It was something that meant a lot to me to carry that torch of Rocky. And so, the ring was amazing. It looked like Madison Square Garden in the Winter Garden Theater. The fights it's choreographed, but I was getting punched in the face every single night. It's knowing how to take a punch and also deliver it and making sure you're not going full force. But I did get hit many times very hard. Which was sort of this is what I signed up for. So there was a lot about that. But I tell you, the last thing I'll talk about Rocky is that it taught me that great lesson of it's not how hard you get hit, it's how hard you get hit and keep moving forward. It's how hard you get hit and that's how winning is done. So anything that gets me down, whether it was injury during Groundhog Day or facing odds that I think I can't face, I know I have the Rocky spirit within me and it's within the story. So I look at it as a glorious time in my life.
Yeah, and working with Aaron Zaflatti too.
Yeah,
great songwriter.
Who knew they could write really good rock tunes? Mm. Three chord rock tunes, Keep On Standing, but they do write some beautiful. There's Raining, which is Adrian's song. It's probably one of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, the cast recording is certainly worth listening to. So Sylvester Stallone with Rocky, Bill Murray with Groundhog Day, and of course Richard Gere with Pretty Woman. You are the musical theatre personification of all of those actors, all very different
very
styles
different.
Of actors.
Thank you for noticing
But so the source material, do you look at those performances on film to inform your work in the musical theatre stage? Obviously it's a different medium, but...
It's inherent in the just in the lexicon of movies that are out there. I've seen every single movie that I've been in, so I'm sure you saw Groundhog Day when you were performing Rita. But I know you don't watch it now. You don't. I don't know. But I think we take the information that is there provided for us. We know that the story works, and you're like, okay, how are we going to musicalize this? How are we going to deconstruct it and put it back together with music?
Yeah.
What do you have to do in order to make these characters, quote, unquote, sing? And you have to have something within them to make them sing. So you have to look at the text. You have to always refer to the text. What am I saying? Who is this character? What does he mean when he's saying these lines? And you can discover that completely for yourself, which is your own ownership of your art, I suppose. So jumping into movie musicals, it takes as much energy as doing a brand new one, yeah. I believe.
I think there's something about the essence of the character. Like, there's something like, whilst those three guys that you just mentioned are all very different, like, Andy has qualities of each of them that then I guess you probably just lean into more.
Yeah.
That I feel
certainly
like
you discover things.
Yeah.
I was not a horrible prick, if I may say, to people in my life, but Phil Connors
no, but
was.
You know how to, like,
no, I'm just saying that's something I needed to discover.
Neither is Bill Murray, you know what I mean? But like you find like what the heart of the character is, what their pain point is, like why they behave the way mm-hmm. they behave in you.
But what about you? You recently came off Mamma Mia.
Yeah.
Mamma Mia has now been around so long that it's like playing Maria in The Sound of Music.
Yeah.
How do you approach Donna when there's all these Donnas that have gone before you? How do you make it Elise McCann's Donna?
Honestly, I didn't look at anything else. I didn't go back and watch Meryl. I didn't like... I did the show 14 years ago when I was like the best friend. To be back 14 years later playing the mum is... sobering, one might say, but also wonderful. And I knew the essence of the show. I knew what the heart of it was. I knew the tone of it and the temperature. And then I literally was like, I'm just going to look at the source material. I'm just going to look at the script. I'm going to look at the songs. I'm just going to make it mine. Like, I just actively tried not to think about, not that I was trying to do something different. I just was like, what feels most honest for me in terms of these given circumstances? And then take the direction to kind of like turn it up or turn it down, you know? For me, it's really just always about trying to find what I think is the most honest version of who that person is, and then trusting the directing team to kind of like help shift you in the direction you need to go, because we obviously can't see outside of ourselves to serve the piece. Like, sometimes there are times where my instinct will think I should be doing this, and then someone will go, oh, actually, you know what, we need you to go here because we need the XYZ. And you're like, great. Now that makes, you know, you kind of make sense of how to keep the character real but also serve the story.
Yeah.
And that sounds super technical and not at all interesting, but it's fascinating. Probably the
truth. So what's Tim Minchin writing next? Because there's bound to be a role in that for you. I mean,
let's hope so. Hey, Timmy, I'm here. No.
You're no novice, of course, with the Minchin repertoire, having played Miss Honey in Matilda and now Rita.
There's something
Hansen.
About the way that Tim, he's so smart and he observes things in the world that we don't talk about or we don't verbalize with as much accuracy as he does. Like, he's just so smart. And the way he is able to communicate all these ideas and pictures and complexities, but then also distill down to like the tiniest, most simple moments of heart is phenomenal, like unparalleled. And there's something about the way that I think his brain works and the way he uses lyric and the way he uses music that makes sense to me. And I think there's something about the way I do it that makes sense to him, because, you know, we've worked together a couple of times. And so I feel like I feel very lucky. But whenever I look at any of his material, I was at his concert recently when it was on, we're doing Mamma Mia. I took the night off and I went and saw his show. And, every song I was like, is a different piece, is a different kind of version or time period of his kind of, you know, legacy of writing. But every one of them, I was like, oh, that, oh, that, oh, that. Like, he just is so excellent at what he does, and it somehow makes sense to the way my brain processes the world. So I feel quite lucky to get to work on his material. It's so cliche to say, but it is such a gift of material, because it's musically complex. It makes you work really hard, but it's got the lyrics are so amazing. They do all the work for you if you can just, like, get your head around them, you know?
I've just finished watching season 2 of The Gilded Age.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, which is fantastic. And I love The Good Fight.
Yes.
And Law and Order. And one of the reasons is because there are so many New York stage actors that are appearing in those shows. Obviously, they're filmed in New York, and it's very handy for those actors. But season 17, Law and Order, SVU, that must have been a thrill, a treat.
Sergeant Mike Dodds, I had an amazing run with that show. I came into a well-oiled machine, which is kind of crazy for a theater actor to jump into a show that has been running for the 17 years at the time. It is now 23 years, which is amazing. It was, but to do your first scenes with Ice-T, who is just listening to his music when I was growing up and knowing where he is and all the things that he's done in his life, and he just carries a lot of wisdom with himself, and you'd see some, like, sort of a god to me, and I get to do scenes with this guy, and it was he was just the most wonderful person. I learned my way around the set, let's just say that. So it took me like an episode or two to make sure that I was, am I doing okay? I'm doing okay. They're keeping me around. Good. So they kept me around for about 17 episodes. And then I found out why my arc was there, to create a drama around somebody getting killed off of the show, which was that was why I was put on that show, I realized. I didn't do any spoilers for anybody out there. The show's been out there and on TV. So it was a tremendous hero's journey and a hero's death, and I carry every moment of that show to this day. And we even just saw an actor
Mandy Bishop. Do you know Mandy Bishop?
Yeah, Mandy.
She's Australian, amazing actor. She has obviously lived in New York for quite a while, and we were in Melbourne doing the show, and we're at a Thirsty Thursdays because she was in town doing the Wharf Review, and she was like, oh my God, I did one episode of Law & Order when I was living in New York, and my scenes were with Andy. Yeah. And I was like, so let me introduce you. So and then she came and saw the show on Sunday.
I saw her, and we recalled the whole episode. I was like, I know exactly that what happened then. It was so wild. So it's far-reaching, SVU. Yeah. It really has a fandom, and we even have fans that come to the stage
door. Like, literally, some girl was like,
just for Law & Order?
Like, flew in to see the show, because she's such a massive fan of Andy's from Law & Order.
Yeah.
So amazing.
And reunited with Peter Gallagher playing your dad.
Yes.
On the 20th century.
Yeah. I think the showrunner saw us there. Yeah. You worked with Peter?
No, I didn't.
No, on the 20th century here.
Oh, you did. You never tell me these things.
No. I did on the 20th century. Please, keep going.
You didn't tell me you did Into the Woods. We have all these connections.
You got Into the Woods in common.
We do.
But Peter Gallagher played my father on SVU, but he played my opposition on the 20th century, but he's just a great performer. I think the showrunners of SVU saw us together on stage and said, that's the thing we want. I was very lucky to get the call.
Good stuff. Well, Groundhog Day, this is a brief time in Sydney. It's been wonderful to chat to you. You're back on stage tomorrow night when you're back in Melbourne. It's a wonderful company, great actors like Andrew Dunn and Michael Linda, Ashley Rubenbach, Jacob Steen, Alison White, Tim Wright, who was one of your fathers in Mamma Mia.
One of our dads in Mamma Mia.
The potential dads.
And he was also in Fiddler on the Roof with me. Original.
So you work with Tim. And Timmy, of course, has a few Broadway credits
He does. Tim was in original Bridges of Madison County, Curious Incident.
Take Me Out.
Yep. He's amazing.
And that magnificent set by Rob Howell.
Yes.
Is worth the price of admission alone. You're playing until April 21.
Yes.
So you've still got a few weeks to go.
Yes. I think tickets are on sale until like the 8th of April.
Right.
So I think we're hoping to go to the end. So please, guys, buy the tickets, and then we'll be able to keep going.
The tickets are going fast. We're starting to fill up now, which is great.
I'm planning to come down April 21st. I read in an email.
Come on down. Maybe they've released them. Maybe it's all sold out, and they needed to release them.
Well, I'll be here, regardless.
Right.
We just hang out.
If not, I'll have to cut out the end of this conversation. At the Princess Theatre, beautiful Princess Theatre. In Melbourne.
Spring Street,
up there. Wonderful show. Music and lyrics by Tim Minchin, and developed and directed by Matthew Warchus. Andy Carl, Elise McCann. I'm not going to do that nonsense again.
Have you ever thought about deja vu? Yeah. I'm going to ask you the question now.
Wow. I do feel like I've been here talking to you before.
Yeah.
It's great. Thank you so much, and all the best for a wonderful season of Groundhog Day.
Thank you so much. Such a great chat.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome back to Stages. We've missed you.
It's good to be back, especially as we enter our seventh season of the podcast, meaning this year we might just hit our 500th episode. Wouldn't that be nice? I did it again. Did I catch you? Did you think you were having your own little Groundhog Day, deja vu? I just, dear listener, I'm being thematic. Melbourne is the third city worldwide to host this enchanting musical comedy in which weatherman Phil Connors is trapped inside one day on endless repeat. The first ever Australian production of Groundhog Day the musical will be exclusive to the Princess Theatre. Leading the cast is Olivier Award-winning and Tony-nominated star Andy Carl. Acclaimed for originating the role of Phil Connors at London's Old Vic and reprising it on Broadway, Carl brings his unmissable performance to the Melbourne stage. And joining Andy in this classic rom-com is Elise McCann as the quick-witted and kind-hearted television producer Rita Hanson. Thank you, Andy and Elise, for your generosity of time and spirit in this debut episode of Season 7. Groundhog Day the Musical, with book by Danny Rubin, music and lyrics by Tim Minchin, developed and directed by Matthew Warchus, is exclusively at Melbourne's Princess Theatre. Tickets on sale via groundhogday.com.au. I'm Peter Eyers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe. And I'll catch you next time on Stages.